As I mentioned, it's always exciting to have the Jazz Cat in the house, and we call this today the Jazz Cat edition of For Locals Only here on Carmel Jazz and Blues Radio as we broadcast live from the Eastwood Building, Carmel by the Sea, California. It's a pretty cool night here, Tuesday, December 11th, 2007. We are studios overlooking the world-famous Hog's Breath Inn. And without any further ado, the Jazz Cat is in studio, and we will have him do his live with the Jazz Cat show right here. So stay right here. We'll be right back with you in about 10 seconds.
So beautiful to be in Carmel, California. It's always a very beautiful place. A little cooler out here this time, not as much warmth, but when you're playing this jazz music, man, there's always a lot of heat. And today, I got a cat that brings a lot of heat, Mr. Dave Liebman.
How you doing, man?
Good, Dave. How are you?
Good. Pleasure to talk to you.
Beautiful, beautiful. Hey, man, you know, I've seen you live and heard you record live. Just wondering how much the audience energy is a part of your, influences your performance.
Well, I must say, if it's good, you feel it. If it's bad, you ignore it. Our first responsibility on the bandstand is to the other musicians and to the music. In other words, to do your job, whatever that is, musically, and to try to keep everybody's attention. Me being a horn player, usually in the position as the kind of the leader, or at least the, you know, the out front man, because nature of the saxophone, you know, you have to get everybody in on the act and their energy and everything, and that's your first job. But assuming that it happens, which is, you know, most of the time, no matter with whom or with what musicians anywhere in the world, really, if the audience is clued in and happening, it definitely raises the energy on the bandstand. There's no question about it. If they're not in, I can't say that it's tracks, but it's certainly, it's just not as pleasant at all.
Well, you know, everyone listens to music differently. I, for one, I like my music complex, man. I like to try to figure out the puzzle, to try to determine the origin, the path of the sound. When you play and compose your music, are you telling a story coming from a spiritual place or just executing great music?
I think it's a combination of all those, Leroy. It's like, I mean, first of all, as I said, your job, you're a musician, your craft is to put the music together and according to the rules and regulations or whatever, customs, you know, whatever the language is that you're speaking at that moment musically with the musician. So you have to try to do that well, of course. And that takes a certain amount of concentration. Obviously, as you get more mature, you're able to do more things sort of automatically so your mind can go to other places. From the spiritual standpoint, I just always feel that we are always trying to get in touch with the, you know, inner core of ourselves, in communication with the others, musicians, hopefully again, as you mentioned, with the audience, and through that to a higher force. I mean, I just take that for granted. I think that's such, you know, what we do every minute when we're up there. Sometimes it connects up better than others, just like anything. And, of course, the other aspect, and for me it's pretty important, and a lot of my music is very, it's almost cinematic. I mean, it is storytelling. I mean, it's not like, you know, you went down to the store, you bought some milk and you came home and you watched television. It's not mundane, yet it's not exact specific, but there's a rise and fall of intensity and emotion and energy that is a story of sorts, without any necessarily detail filled in, but a curve and a feeling of different colors and moods and atmospheres and so forth, and that for me is quite important. I mean, that is part of music in general, and some musicians emphasize that more than others. I mean, there have been whole musical fields, for example, New Age music was really an attempt to take one aspect of atmosphere and color and really exaggerate and emphasize it. For us, it's just a matter of trying to shift things, keep it interesting, and keep a lot of variety going of mood and feeling and color. So all the things you refer to are hopefully in the pot at the same time when you're playing, if you can. You know, that's the challenge.
Yeah. You know, one of my favorite recordings, live recordings to listen to, is Fancy Free with Elvin Jones, man. That one's recorded back at the Lighthouse back in the day.
Right.
And, you know, you've been a catalyst for many creative ensembles. I'm sure the Train is a big part of your heart.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Once you saturate yourself with that sound, what is your ideology to take the music to new horizons?
Well, you know, you have to know the past in any art form. It's your responsibility, if you're going to be valid, is to know what came before in order to both repeat what came before, alter what came before, and do what wasn't there or what wasn't appearing to be there, because, of course, everything's been done in one way or the other, but it's a matter of shifting things and mixing them up. So I think we have a path when you have if you have a long creative life, you have a chance to do all those three stages, which is to learn what came before and imitate it, absorb it, and stylize it in your way, and then hopefully to add something to the language or to the instrument, in this case, the instrument playing the language, that was not seen or heard before. I mean, everything's been heard in some way, but the combination may not have been. So that's kind of a ongoing path, and of course, somebody like a Coltrane, who I studied so much, and playing, as you mentioned, at Fancy Free, being able to play with Elvin Jones, you know, who was Coltrane's drummer for that very important period in the 60s, and to be able to go with Miles Davis, who, of course, was Coltrane's, you know, employer for a certain amount of time, was a chance for me to really see firsthand what it was like to be in the heat with those musicians and that level of musicianship. And, of course, when that stage came to its end, it's my, you know, early years in the 70s, you know, it was my responsibility to really try to make something that was an amalgamation of my influences with a homage to my influences and an honesty, but with something that was mine. And of course, all you have to do for the first part is look around you at your period of history. We had rock and roll, fusion, world music that those people were just beginning to. I mean, Coltrane certainly was, and Miles did, you know, Sketches of Spain and so forth, and of course, fusion. But we were able to, you know, keep moving that forward, but also electronic instruments and synthesizers and so forth. So there was a certain amount of material that we could do that would change things and make it a little bit different. And for me, that was very important in the 80s and 90s. And, of course, ultimately, it comes down to your instrument and how you transform your instrument into your own personal vehicle and maybe into something that hasn't been played before on that instrument. And that's something, of course, you've worked on your whole life.
You're listening to Dave Liebman right here on the show, live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM KRML, Jazz and Blues Radio, on the For Locals Only show with Mr. Gary Hamada. Well, you know, Dave, man, I'm 44 years old, and to this day, I don't know what corner I was on musically back in the 70s, but as you mentioned, you hit with Miles as he was embarking on some of those new horizons that we were talking about. Where were you mentally in your musical endeavors, and how excited were you to take some new directions with Miles?
Well, first of all, just being on a bandstand and being chosen was, you know, beyond belief, honor and privilege and opportunity. So no matter what Miles would have been playing, that would have been just an amazing thing right there. The fact that in that period of 73 and 4, Beyond the Corner stuff, which now is getting a lot of publicity because they just released this big box set of the recording sessions. It was a very, I mean, it was so, things were happening so fast and so off, so much happening in music in the 60s and the early 70s, with all influences coming from so many places, that you really, you know, when you're in the middle of something, you're not that aware of it. It felt pretty disorganized and chaotic, and I wasn't sure he knew what he's doing, although, of course, I knew he knew what he was doing, because he's Miles Davis and had a 30-year track record by that time. But I was a young musician and just trying to do my part of it and make sure that he was, you know, happy with me, obviously, and play what I thought would be the appropriate thing. It is now, in retrospect, especially now since we are going through this period of reexamination of that music, that I see the implications of what he was trying to do. Some of it successful, some of it less so, but he certainly didn't mind taking a chance. I mean, Miles was a process. He was always in process. He was never a finished product. And that was the beauty about his whole thing and his whole life, that he was always moving. The musicians around him had to stay up with him, and he always had good guys who could, you know, contribute something. So it's kind of, with Miles, it's like when you hear it after. I mean, after could be decades, as it is in this case. You say, oh, that was an interesting thing. At the time, I can't say I was totally aware of what we were doing, but probably why I could just take part in it without being self-conscious, you know.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering because, you know, the music was so controversial for the time. I was wondering if you felt that, you know, Miles was really on to something, or it's like, hey, man, he's Miles.
I wasn't sure, Leroy. I tell you, man, you were up there, you were with him, so you did what you had to do, but when you went back and listened to it or talked to your friends or your peers, you know, it was a lot of confusion, a lot of excitement, though, because there was definitely a feeling that something was going on that hadn't been before, and that, that Miles was doing it meant something. If you or I did it, it wouldn't mean the same thing. The fact that he was doing it, of course, put attention on it, and the fact that it was controversial was because he moved so quickly in those years. I mean, when he started playing electric, which was 68, more or less, 69, with Silent Way, by 71, he had already changed it twice, and by 73, he changed it again until 75, and then, of course, we know what happened in the 80s when he came back. And, you know, the audience really could not keep up with it. I mean, it was just impossible to know what he was doing because he was moving at a very, very quick rate, as was Coltrane in his music from the 60s to 67. So when you have musicians of that stature and that kind of speed of development and creativity, I don't know if anybody can really say, oh, this is what's happening now. They really have to wait until the dust settles now, I think.
Yeah, well said. Well, you know, also speaking of the 70s, there was in New York, there was a loft scene where everybody got together and jammed with each other. I mean, how was that? And was there any place on Earth, or is there any place on Earth now that has that kind of environment in this day and age?
Well, it was a very important part of my life. I had lofts from 69 to 81 till I moved out of New York proper. I had about six or seven lofts. You know, you had to move a lot. It was landlord problems and rents and all that, but that was our laboratory. I mean, that's where I made all my, basically, contacts with my peers and experimented. We played a lot of free jazz. We were very affected, for my period and my contemporaries, very affected by the record Ascension in 1966, where Coltrane really let things go with a whole bunch of horn players, eight horn players. And we kind of did that for a couple of years and then worked our way back to so-called, let's say, bebop, but, you know, to the more conventional playing. And then, of course, a lot of us just started playing and becoming the next generation of musicians on the map. But it was a very important thing, and it was from the 60s to the 70s. And it was socio-economical. It was, you know, cheap, even in terms of the relative terms of the dollar. It was cheap even then because it was industrial areas. Nobody really was supposed to live there. They were very funky kind of places. But you could play at night, and you could play in the weekend and so forth, and painters could paint because they had room, and photographers had light and so forth. So it was great in Manhattan at that time. For now, I mean, the last 10 years, I mean, you know, New York, like everywhere else in the world, has finally been gentrified for the most part. I mean, at least Manhattan, where this activity was taking place. And it's impossible to have that scene anymore. You just can't afford it. And if you were that kind of person, that has that kind of money, you're not going to be doing that. But there still is a certain amount of an incubation feeling to New York now, based on the schools, because there's at least 7 to 10 schools in the New York area where jazz is taught, university, college level. And that means a lot of young musicians from all over the world still congregate in New York. So I still have to say that for jazz, I mean, that word is a little bit, you know, we'd have to define it in a way, but for the creative music that we call jazz, New York still has the probably the most energy in the world, you know. And it's not in lofts anymore. It's different. It's in clubs for the door, and it's in little art galleries and museums and so forth. And you know, they find their way, the young people, but it's still a lot of energy. That loft period was a unique era.
Yeah, man, jazz music is definitely the hippest music in the world, brother.
I agree, man. I think it's the most humane music in the world. I mean, you know, there's some great folk and, you know, world music, of course, that have to do with the religion and the customs and the social aspects of a certain society. I mean, it could be, you know, New Guinea or Polynesia or Bulgaria or whatever, you know, that's unbelievable. But what jazz is a gigantic melting pot of many, many musics. It began that way. It has remained something that is able to take from and put it together. And it's modern because it's on the spot happening in front of you. I mean, it's the music that when you see it, that's what's happening. There's no past. There's no future. There's no other music like that. I mean, hip-hop music is about a period, a time that was, you know, was recorded as it is, no, you know, and keep repeating it. And classical music is even more so like that. But when you hear jazz done by great guys, I mean, you want to talk present time, that is being there big time. You know, there is There's nothing but this moment.
Yeah, man. Absolutely. You're listening to Dave Liebman right here on the show live with the Jazz Cat. My name is Leroy Downs on 1410 AM KRML Jazz and Blues Radio on the For Locals Only show with Mr. Gary Hamada. Well, you know, Train, we spoke of Train, he made this transition to soprano from tenor after Miles gave him one. How did that transition come about for you?
Well, I heard from Steve Lacy, of course, who was the prime soprano player of our time. He was, at that time, playing only soprano. That was, he's the only one, really, or the only one known. And what he says, you know, it was through Don Cherry, who was a friend of both of Train and Steve Lacy, that he got turned on to it. Because Train didn't really play it, and with Miles, he picked it up afterwards. And of course, My Favorite Things was his signature tune and became a so-called hit. So therefore, it was placed for the soprano in that tune, and then more so in the other songs like that. But I think Train, I mean, he indicated in interviews and so forth that he liked the, obviously, the portability of it, the fact that it was easier to hold and to practice, because he was such a heavy practicer. He could lay in the bed and practice, as a soprano used to say. You know, he just kind of lay flat with it. You didn't have to worry about it. And, the nice thing about the soprano that, of course, I'm kind of imagining he liked, is that it's an octave higher than the tenor in the same range as the trumpet. And you hear differently because you're up higher. It's a little clearer in some ways. Train really did bring in a certain Indian influence in sound and style that was unique to what he did on the soprano. But the fact that he brought the soprano back from relative obscurity outside of Steve Lacy, really, it was only Sidney Bechet who was still alive at that period, but of course, it was a historical figure from the 20s and 30s. Between him and Steve Lacy, there wasn't anybody, really, and Train really brought the instrument back to the plate. And when I began playing, I mean, I started on tenor, and I played clarinet and flute and all that stuff, but when I got in my first real band, it was a fusion band called Ten Wheel Drive. I mean, the guy said, you have to get a soprano. I had to go out and buy one, and that was the beginning of playing soprano. And then, of course, now it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. But Train is really responsible for getting it back on the map, and he had a unique sound and style on it, no question about it.
Well, you know, you've had so many albums on a variety of different labels, and you know you're not the kind of cat that just keeps doing the same regurgitations of standards. I mean, you're an explorer, and you seem to play in a large variety with a large variety of musicians as well. Is it hard to get the labels behind the idea of forward-thinking compositions?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, business is not it's the nature of what business is about, making money, and art is about making art. And if the two coincide, it's a lovely world for those people. because then everybody can pat themselves in the back and say, oh, we pushed the art forward and we made a living at it. And that's rare. I mean, usually art has got to be somehow, and that's why, for example, there's so much activity in Europe. I'm in Europe most of the time, but there is support still generated by the governments there. But there is really a conflict between commerce and art, period, from the beginning of time. I'm sure some caveman would say the same thing, and we just that's the way it is. And in my case, as you mentioned, I have so many styles that I've been interested in, recorded in so many different musicians worldwide, that it's been hard to pin me down. It's either because of that I was never with a label for years and years and years, or it was the label, it was the chicken and the egg. I'm not sure which it was. It was because I chose to be like that, or because that was the way it was. In any case, I've been, in some ways very fortunate. I remember talking to Chick Corea years ago, and when he had a, pretty ironclad contract with a label, and he said, you're really lucky, man, you can do what you want. I said, well, yeah, but you're lucky because you get support and you have continuity. So it works both ways. In my case, I'm pretty happy with it. It takes a lot more work. You got to hustle up the deal, and you got to, figure out your logistics because you're dealing with so many different elements. But on the other hand, I can play standards for one label. Just as you called, I'm at the piano working on a record I'm going to do in Holland in March, the music of Kurt Weill, and I'm working on My Ship right now, as you called. On the other hand, I just finished the record with Saxophone Summit with Lovano and Robbie Coltrane, where we did some Coltrane and original tunes, and we're doing the mixing now and editing and so forth. So my life can go from standards to originals to free jazz to chamber jazz to big band to whatever. We just finished a tour with Quest, my band, with Richie Byrek, Ron McClure, and Billy Hart in Europe, and that's playing post Coltrane, post Miles kind of music. So in a way, it works to your advantage, and if you can your audience can hang with you, the people who like you, then it's great. They come and say, oh, what's he doing now? What's that guy going to be into now? And I think that's okay.
Well, sweet, man. Well, you know, I think everybody's going to say that they love Dave Liebman, man. You're a player, an educator. You know, you've written books in regard and support of the music, the world's most beautiful, innovative music in the world. This art form is what we live for, man. And I'd like to thank you for coming on the air with me today, man, and definitely not adding any water to the sound, man. We enjoy the purity of it.
Thank you so much, and hello to all my friends out there, and I hope to see you all soon.
Absolutely, man.
Okay,
Dave Liebman right here on Live with the Jazz Cat on 1410 AM KRML Jazz and Blues Radio on the Four Locals Only Show with Mr. Gary Hamada.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let's play a little bit of more of Dave Liebman, and I'll tell you more about this composition in a moment. Thank you to the Jazz Cat. If you would like more information regarding his show and all the archived interviews, I mean, you're talking about the jazz luminaries. If you want to go behind the scenes, I know a lot of you out there are certainly enjoy the music, but if you want to get a more insightful idea of these very talented individuals, I consider them to be at a much higher intellect than a lot of what we would call musicians. Jazz musicians have always had that special intellect, and again, you hear that in people like Dave Liebman. Also, you will find all those interviews exclusively here on Caramel Jazz and Blues Radio by going to the Jazz Cat's website, and that website is www.thejazzcat.net.